Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
Everybody up! Of Zuma Time. I'm your host, Dr. Mark, your culture vulture. Number to call to get on the air with me is 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. Boy, the world is really upset this week, isn't it? Really aggravated. It's actually a show every day at 3 o'clock on the MSNBC. MS imbeciles. Angry in America. Everybody's mad. I love it. I absolutely love the venom. Bring it on. Bring on your tea party. Bring on your volcano. Bring on your trade Big Ben Roethlisberger. Bring it on. It's the spring. Irritation. Pretty soon, the bugs will be back. Wow. So anyway, Mets down 3-1 here in the, looks like the sixth inning? Can't read that. I think it's the fifth. Anyway, I'm not worried. Not much. So tonight we'll have a canned interview with a kangaroo that I talked to yesterday, Dr. Keith Hammond, in Auckland, New Zealand. Yes, octopussy. Yes, Auckland, New Zealand. And, you know, I wanted to get someone who isn't mired down in, you know, the American nightmare we're in, to sort of lift the canopy a little bit on healthcare from another perspective, from outside the States. And he's a chiropractor, you know, like me, sort of. And, you know, we wrapped for a good 45 minutes. So we're going to start that interview at 9:20. You can jump into the chat room at that point. Any questions, any comments, anything you want me to get to. When we get to the back end of the show at the top of the hour, I'll be happy to oblige. There's so much to say, so much to say. So let's start with our volcano. You know, the volcano, it's become quite popular, and it actually now has its own song. So for the first time on these airways, I'm going to share that with you and see what we get for our volcano song here. So let's refrain from any IMing during the song. Volcano song.
Thank you.
all going to hell. If this is the song they came up with for this guy. Ayoko Luku, look at the buku.
Hey!
There you go, your volcano song. Goofy as hell. A little more of that. How do you spell this thing? I get your hookah, hookah, hookah. Who the hell knows? Anyway, the thing is still raging out of control, and they were expecting another volcanic eruption up there, and if you've been stuck in Europe or stuck here at JFK and sleeping on your luggage, Mother Nature is having a little bit of a purge. There's been all kinds of earthquakes and all kinds of funky things bopping all over the planet. We've discussed on the air here at some time. I don't entirely think it's natural because of the existence of the harp instrument of destruction. So anyone want to Google harp, give me some heat for it. Go ahead. I can take it. I know what's coming. But, you know, every time we get, you know, another natural disaster, we get one of these funky backbeats. Hey! Ayukuduku, ukukuduku. Unbelievable. So there's that one. And then there's this story with Big Ben. Talk about, you know, a volcano erupting. The most damning character assassination of Ben Roethlisberger. This is an article from Dan Wetzel from Yahoo Sports. In the wake of sexual assault allegations, an incident that earned him, well, it came out to be 6-game suspension, 4 if he gets off of good behavior. It doesn't come from the 527-page Georgia police report. The Steelers, which are, you know, they're an old-school team, are shopping this eco, the 28-year-old two-time Super Bowl champion quarterback, because tomorrow is the draft, the big draft. I will be going to the Jet Party, actually, at the New Meadowlands, unsponsored by corporate, you know, coffers yet. Check out the new field and watch the first round over there in the fancy club. I'll be wearing my giant garb, so this might be the last time you hear me alive. But I'm going in. It's my turf. Damn tenants. Anyway, big fly bowl. Nope, no good. So if the Steelers believed in Big Ben and his ability to change his personal life, they take his penalty and move on, it'd be simple for Roethlisberger to avoid the situation that got him in trouble, stay out of college bar bathrooms and drunken co-eds. What are you asking, an eco to, you know, live on nothing? On the surface, this isn't a drug or alcohol problem. This is a situation where lousy childhood friends are dragging him down. The straight and narrow doesn't require a major life change, just interact with women like a man, namely grow up. It ought to be simple. He's eco. The Steelers obviously don't think it's such a sure thing. They're so concerned he isn't going to settle down with a nice girl or a quiet life like, ooh, I don't know, Eli, also drafted in the same year as Ben Roethlisberger, live a quiet life. They're going to cut bait with him for this you know, trade with the top 10 team. It comes down to how well you know the individual player. This is Mark Cuban talking. Oh, boy. Another Pittsburgh native. You have to know the Dallas Maverick owner. He's kind of a nutball. You have to know whether the player is willing to change, says the Anto. If he's not willing to right the ship, you have to get rid of him. Hmm. Cuban would have his way to say he doesn't know him, so shut up. But we asked a rich owner from Pittsburgh if he'd trade the guy. He does know what it's like to own a team and discipline players. If Roethlisberger was essentially a good guy who engaged in some bad behavior one night, then you draw the line. This is how bosses and parents and school principals discipline every single day. It's not that Roethlisberger didn't take precautions. He had a designated driver and a security team. He got pictures of him drinking erased. These are actually mature decisions. The Steelers don't think it matters. They're not convinced it won't happen again. No team would ever trade a talent like Roethlisberger if they thought he could change. Yet the Rooney family that owns the franchise takes its place in Pittsburgh culture seriously, and yes, it does operate at a higher morality level than other teams. It's their quarterback. They didn't dump Roethlisberger when he was dumb enough to ride and wreck his motorcycle without a helmet. They didn't dump one woman in Reno, Nevada, Reno, Nevada, Reno, Nevada, 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 alleged a sexual assault case of her own. They didn't dump wide receiver Santonio Holmes, who caught Big Ben's final second touchdown pass in the Super Bowl 2 seasons ago, the first time he had an off-field incident. They have since. The Steelers aren't rigid, iron-fisted disciplinarians. The Steelers are out of patience with him. So let's see. They get Sam Bradford from St. Louis. Well, you know, all this will unfold tomorrow. Again, this is what makes the world go round, these little stories. But then there's this other thing, this Goldman Sachs thing, that is getting people nutty. I mean, I'm here in New York, so it's a big topic on my table because a lot of people make their living down at the tip of Manhattan. And it gets a little crazy when you have a lawsuit like this. Let's see if anything's turned over lately. Because it's been, like, you know, on a daily basis, there's been reactions to this, as the president, of course, is doing his deal. I love it. When the president does something he can't do, and, I don't know, it's just weird watching the whole thing go by. All right, let's see. Here's an article from Guardian Unlimited. This should be good. Goldman Sachs is not an evil bank. That's the title. Blaming banks for financial crisis is unfair. They are a symptom, not the cause of the disease. The knives are out for the vampire squid, says Seth Friedman. All right. Guardian. This is a UK article. The question is whether Goldman Sachs is convicted of fraud over the Abacus affair. The Abacus affair has been reduced to a minor detail, with the usual suspects happy to declare the bank guilty from the time off, regardless of whether or not ultimately proved innocent. Ever since the credit crisis brought the global economy to its knees, there's been little sympathy for letting bankers have a fair trial, especially if it gets in the way of detractors venting of their self-righteous rage. Guilt is in the eye of the beholder, and in Goldman's case, as well as the plethora of big banks before them, those looking on have nothing but contempt for those working within the belly of the financial beast. I will be in the belly of the financial beast tomorrow, by the way, at the old Meadowlands, or the new Meadowlands. Oh boy, ain't that some karma. Let's see. We've been there before, with media commentators and politicians calling for the heads to roll, regulators to sweep in the industry clean, and outraged members of the public throwing their uninformed and hypocritical two pence worth into the mix for good measure. I'm reading with a British accent because it's a British article. Such talk makes for great copy in the papers and fills common threads and letters columns, but does nothing to address the core problem at the heart of both the banking world and society as a whole. I'm waiting for what is the core of this thing? Even if Goldman Sachs employees are guilty of the charges against them, they are not the special breed of evil banker. As Dean Baker noted, in fairness to Goldman, there is no reason to believe that they are any less ethical than the other two or three big Wall Street actors, just more effective. So they're better crooks. But it doesn't end there. The banking industry is not singularly malicious. It's not the only entity adrift in a sea of worldwide righteousness. However, much the naysayers preach, the opposite is true. When I interviewed Simon Cockwell, not Simon Cowell, also known in city circles as Evil Knievel, for my book Binge Trading, he launched a devastating and damning critique of Gordon Brown's handling of the British economy. He described as the greatest peacetime deception ever. All right, he's going off on a tangent that I'm not going to follow. The Goldman Sachs affair are not to be taken lightly, but at the same time should be viewed as the context of the entire political and financial system in which smoke and mirrors are the integral part of the process rather than a one-off anomaly. The knee-jerk response of the banking, anti-banking masses is to call yet again for tighter regulation. Greed is good regardless of scale. Attacking the underlying lust for lucre should be a central plank of the platform of anyone who truly wants to eradicate the endemic corruption of the world of big or small business. The Wild West Badlands of the CDO market only existed because no one on the outside cared enough to properly regulate them when it was going good. For all the 2020 hindsight displayed after the event, it is all but guaranteed the future crises were born out of similarly lax approaches taken by the next generation of half-hearted compliance officers. All right, enough of him. Basically, everybody's still yakking, but we're still dealing with a volcano, right? To me. I mean, at the end of the day, you could play this for Goldman Sachs and for Ben. It's all akajigukukakatukuka. All right? I Love this song. Catchy. All right, anybody around? Nobody's around. We're going to open up the chat room, see if anybody wants to talk to poor old me. There I am. 646-478-4847, 646-478-4847. All right, chat room is open, and what we're going to do here is take a little listen to our friend Keith Hammond. And I know right at the beginning of this, I tried to make this an exact copy, but it's impossible. We have many technical difficulties along the way, so, you know, once in a while. Come on. There it is.
Boozy, boozy, bop, city bop.
Yeah, once in a while you get it right. So anyway, without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Keith Hammond, as recorded, actually, earlier today in New Zealand. So I'll be back at the top of the hour to clean up any things that we missed or answer any questions, or we'll do a little dancing. Aka kazuku, chuko chakaka. All right, here's me and Keith yapping it up. Enjoy.
Base a level rather than
oh, right here, there's a screw up here. Okay, here it starts now. Okay, joining us now live and in the future, we have Dr. Keith Hammond from Auckland, New Zealand, who's going to be talking to us from a different point of view tonight about some of the things that have been going on here in our little cesspool called America. So, picking up where we didn't leave off, because no one was going to hear that first interview, we had a little cosmic veto there. We want to pick up where you left off. You said to sort of give people an introduction to you. You born and raised California, went to school at LACC out in LA there, the chiropractic college that sort of became a health science university. You got out to New Zealand in 97, and you know, it seems like we've gone leaps and bounds since the late 90s, early part of the last decade, as far as people being health conscious. But we still live in a culture here that is very disease oriented. You know, we went through the swine flu thing last year. I don't even know if that touched you guys. Maybe you can educate us about that. And just, you know, from you went out there for lifestyle reasons, and we talked a little bit, you know, in the pre-interview about how this has impacted the way the people in the culture perceive chiropractic. What is it about your job right now as a chiropractor? What do you see your role in people's lives as compared to here, where we're still looked at as, for the most part, what the Yellow Pages have been labeling us for, you know, 40, 50 years now, as basically there for you know, musculoskeletal stuff. What's your role in a client's life? When I walk in your door tomorrow, what's the role you're going to be playing for us?
Well, my role that I see, as I see it, in the way we run our practice now, is looking at trying to develop ways to ensure that people don't need to come and see us. Looking at that, we're actually starting to look at, we have to look at lifestyle models and the way people are thinking and the way people are acting and looking for congruence, with what they say they want and what they're actually willing to do. I think that's probably the biggest challenge is looking at that. The adjusting side of chiropractic is an important part and integral to what we do, but, that I see that as being almost a sad point when they have to be adjusted. We don't want to have to adjust them. They should be able to remain subluxation free, free of nerve interference, everything functioning well if they're leading their life that way and not exposed to excessive levels of stress. So that's kind of the way that we are running our practice.
And that's 180 degrees from the wellness practices here that preach people need to get checked every week, adjusted every week because they're falling apart because of all the stress. Your model says, you come to me, we clear you up, and your body, oh, that weird thing, innate intelligence, actually can sustain and receive that adjustment and operate at a higher level. And so you're basically coming in to raise your level of performance rather than regain it. That's a completely, you know, proactive 180-degree model from anything I see here, because most of the stuff you see here, like I said, you have to justify your existence. And we talked about the closet vitalism in chiropractic that's going on here. I don't know if you saw this post from Matt McCoy a couple of days ago. Maybe it was actually this morning. Everything seems to run together. What happened in the British Chiropractic Association, the Guardian, I guess it's kind of a big-time thing out there, says is having a other issue with adjusting kids, asymptomatic kids. And they seem to start these things like almost like, you know, like every couple of months there'll be like another one of these, like, don't adjust kids, watch out for stroke, you know, all the warnings against anyone ever getting touched by a chiropractor. Meanwhile, third leading cause of death is mainstream Western medicine. So do you guys experience the same degree of, you know, of sort of, you know, being excluded from the healthcare community that we would hear? I'm just trying to get a bird's eye view of what you guys go through in terms of the way you integrate with other professions.
It's actually quite interesting. We because the medicine here is socialized, we do tend to be excluded, and in a way that is good, because we don't really want to be thrown into the socialized medicine realm, because it gets really murky and there's a whole lot of politics that come into it. But there are a large number of referrals that do come from the medical side, sending over to us. They're starting to get, some of them are starting to get the idea as we present them more research and showing how things are going. And there's actually been some amazing research done by Heidi Taylor out of the New Zealand College of Chiropractic. She's been doing some wonderful things, just kind of validating what we do. And as that research keeps getting presented to the medical community, it is starting to make a difference. Generally speaking, with some of the younger doctors rather than maybe the older ones who have been kind of locked into that that somatic space of you know, buying into pharma is everything, we are, you know, kind of starting to work our way into the younger generation of doctors. I think that's the big thing, especially as they are kind of the with a lot of the graduates that we've graduated out of the school here, they're of a similar age, and so they're kind of meeting on the same basis, which is usually working for us quite well.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and it's nice that you guys have some harmony there, because, you know, we've had a lot of skeptics against chiropractic here, of course. And again, I've been in the profession too long to know, you know, that the politics play a role on both sides here. You know, I came through the Wilt case in the 80s and late 70s and 80s, and then all the way through managed care and everything else. But you see this British Chiropractic Association, they're the skeptic in Britain, said that in talking about pediatric care, that manipulating baby spines in accordance with the teachings of chiropractic is more than usually nutty American faith healing. All right, so they get to say that, and there was no libel, like he won the suit. So basically, again, public perception, and then you have your personal experience, and people that have a personal experience with chiropractic can justify a lot of things more for themselves than they could for the masses. And that's why when I think about it as that closet vitalism, what is it about the way that we deliver our message? And I'm very interested in the semantics of this. Because I gave a talk, I don't know how long ago it was, probably in the wake of 9/11, probably 2002 or 3, one of them, down in Sherman, very straight school, may or may not have heard of, on the East Coast here. And they were talking about the 33 principles, which is all anybody talks about. And I, you know, went up there and I said, you know, I looked at these 33 principles and I started to count. And they only say the word subluxation in them 3 times, but they say the word intelligence in them 33 times. And so if you think the center of chiropractic is about subluxation, and you're talking about these principles, you're not making any sense to me, because almost every other line is something about intelligence here. Why are we not talking about the intelligence of the system? Why are we not researching what recuperative power is? Because in every state in the country here, they say that no one challenges this, by the way, not even the medics, that the chiropractors work with the inherent recuperative power of the body. Wait a minute. What's that? Why are we researching that? Why are we over here researching what happens to sore muscles and old discs and, you know, and scoliosis and all the other, you know, sort of put a fork in it kind of conditions, when we're actually working with something that is immaterial? So, again, talking about it philosophically, since you're doing something that has a lifestyle component to it, that has a sort of an out there sort of long-term benefit, how do you communicate that message to somebody without sounding like a faith healer?
That is the trick. Looking at, you know, as many of us know, it's trying to paint a picture for. I find that the best method seems to be trying to paint a picture for them of something that is bigger than themselves. Trying to help reconnect them with something a bit larger than themselves, and that's not that easy. But I kind of start working from the bottom up and asking people, you know, so, you know, where do you see yourself when you're 70 or 80? You know, what do you picture yourself as when you get there? And we start from there and kind of work our way backward, because the you know, my approach has always been, you know, begin with the end in mind, to some degree, that we, in order to move forward, we've got to be having a plan. We've got to know where we're going. Otherwise, we're just kind of walking along following the rest of the cattle. And, you know, people who are walking into my office, generally speaking, aren't cattle, because they've come to my office. So we are, you know, we're dealing with the people who are actually thinking a bit more laterally, a bit more broadly. And if you just kind of hold them by the hand and walk them down that path a little bit, get them an idea of where they need to go, and then set them on their way, they seem to kind of grab hold of that, and some miraculous changes can happen from there.
And again, this is something that in the research community, which I've been, you know, rattling around in for about 12, 13 years now, is very, very misunderstood in terms of the language. Because psychologists who deal with the mind, of course, can't put a fork in that, but they can come up with a zillion different conditions that make them into diseases. Shyness is now social phobia, for example. All the neural behavioral disorders, there's a book called Alphabet Kids with 70 neural behavioral disorders that all overlap, because once a kid demonstrates a behavior, well, now I can have an opinion about that behavior is going to be good for school or not good for this, and basically create a system around it based on these very, very loose observations. But for some reason, because the chiropractors are dealing with the other side of the coin, and in my parlance, the soma, the living body, there's almost like there's a certain rules of the road here. Well, you can say almost anything about somebody's mind and get away with it, but when you start saying it about their body, which is what was in Stevenson's, he talks about physics.
All right.
Okay, I'm back.
You're back. Awesome.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
I tell you, all right, Mercury retrograde is in full effect here, because we're definitely getting killed here in this thing. All right, well, I don't know if you heard my last comment there about physical insanity, but hopefully we have it all recorded on the back end, or we could be doing this interview three times here. The concept of it is in the Stevenson's book. Again, these guys waved this green book at me for 25 years, and I still haven't think they read the damn thing. And physical insanity basically is about the old concept of you know, the safety pin, where if you get interference between the brain and the body, distortion, no matter what it is, disturbance even just irritation, that the system is going to respond in a deranged way. It's going to lose its rhythm. And by losing its rhythm, it becomes hyper or hypo, too much or too little, and in its tonicity. And over time, that's going to lead to physical abnormalities that we would call, you know, the Western model, neuromusculoskeletal conditions, which can become organic conditions, which become a whole bunch of systemic conditions. But we don't care about that. We care about the first part. And what would trigger this physical insanity would be the perception of danger. And this is why I'm telling you, chiropractors missed the boat on this a long time ago. We took the environment away from the body. They never do that with mental conditions, because if you're afraid of snakes, well, that's the environment you have to deal with, right? Phobias and things like that. But because the body's mostly memory, in chiropractic, we don't teach that we're cleaning out the body. If you can go to someone's computer and say, hey, you know, we got to clear your cache, we got all this spyware in there, and your computer's going to work better. Nervous systems are wired in a 1-0 type of a format for the synaptic transmission of messages, right? But the non-synaptic transmissions of messages, which is more of the gray zone, is where all this interference kind of hangs out. It's noisy there, and you have to have a good signal-to-noise ratio. Most people understand biofeedback better than they do chiropractic, because it's obvious. We've failed to make it obvious, because we focused on the two extremes, health and disease, and everything in between is where vitality is. And I think that's where this profession, because we're the closet vitalists, and we talk in this kind of wonky subluxation-based model, which is extremely mechanical and very literal, by the way. And in an effort to be obvious, we actually take all the subtle stuff we do out of the soup. And so you're left with a bunch of dumplings and a spoon tapping around and going, there's no soup here. And it's not a tasty message to pass on to somebody because it always sounds like a downer. And you know, when you're working with kids, you're working with people that are basically rejuvenating themselves as they come in. It has nothing to do with what you're doing on the table. Nothing. The table is the cherry on the top. It's everything they're doing between sessions that they feel that they're going to recover. You know what it's like when someone regains, you know, hope that they're going to be okay. Chiropractors don't get seduced by, oh my God, it's this, oh my God, it's that. Every day around here, I have to talk somebody out of the tree because somebody told them that they might have this or they might have that. Now, I don't know if you guys are that lab happy or that, you know, MRI happy out there, but what is it about the aging process and the developmental process that people miss? Why is it the physiology gets thrown away with, you know, with the baby with the bathwater? Do you guys talk in a more, you know, non-pathological type of language, or do you guys have to kind of constantly decode that for people?
I think it's part of the Western society is that we are. A lot of Western society has been locked into this materialism and the everything external to me is what is important. And so I do see that the manifestation of all the symptoms and the things and the, you know, the ranting about obesity and diabetes and all these things, which are merely the ongoing, you know, effects from that lack of integration, like you were discussing before. That we still see that here, and you really do have to get people more in touch with themselves, and actually get them to actually understand that there is this body is not just this thing that you carry your brain around in. It is it's a part of you, and that you are connected to everything else that is around you, and forming that connection between everybody, between each individual person is what actually helps generate that love of humanity. If we're looking at the bigger picture, that interconnectedness, but also from the standpoint of health and wellness, if we're going to be, you know, vital, the vitality starts at the very, very smallest, minute, interconnected electrical signals and waves that we're doing, that our body is created out of, that we have to be dealing down to that, and that is really what chiropractic is about, is actually getting down to helping re-engage that harmony. That's really the trick of it, and I think that getting people to understand that is challenging. But when you see the light bulb come on, it's like magic.
Yeah, when they finally understand it, then a lot of the paradigms that they've been carrying about, you know, their perception of themselves, identity-wise, and also their perception of their future. Because most of the time, when you discuss somebody's future, it's all relative to their current age. You know, a teenager never dies. He's just going to keep going on forever. He feels invincible. When you get someone in their 30s and 40s, they start dreading a lot of talk about their future because they're looking at it as, you know, things are starting to be taken away from them. And then when you deal with a senior, you know, especially a senior who's been suffering with a condition for a while and maybe moving along and had to be told 5 or 6 times, well, you got to live with that. I mean, their perception of the future is not good at all. So it's like if everything is about prevention and everything is about this proactive stuff, where is this healthy, fantastic future we're all going to live when we just keep pushing it along, you know, like a broom? Why can't we bring the future into the present? And that involves being able to shift the person's awareness from, like you just said, from an outside in to an inside out orientation. And that to me is what chiropractic, because it still operates in a third person type of language, which is very medical, misses the boat. If they operate from a first person, which again, we get into the taboo of subjectivity and kinesthetic and feelings and all that stuff, ooey-ooey stuff, except when the medical doctors call it emotional intelligence, then it's all fine. How do we get this, you know, sort of like, you know, this lingo into the schools? I know the schools, you know, are getting a little more progressive here because they're getting desperate, but they're still doing it. They're sprinkling some vitalistic flakes on this big allopathic third-person structural model. You know, can we say tensegrity out loud and all sing kumbaya? Can we? I talk a lot about salutogenesis, which is the parallel to pathogenesis, the origin of well-being as opposed to the origin of disease. Do you think it's much more about a language thing, or do you think it's much more about an experiential, a personal experiential thing that has to be tagged with different words so that when the person has that experience at the table you're talking about and they feel that sense of vitality come over them, they can go out and tell the other person the experience without, you know, basically coughing it up into a shell of third person types of descriptions. How do we get this thing moving out of this kind of kind of linguistic traffic we're in?
Yeah, I think that what we have to be able to do is it is you know, what we're talking about is if we look at some of the sociology kind of things, is we're talking about you and I belong to a cult, and we belong to this cult that isn't part. But cult can become culture. It's just adding a couple more letters onto it. And I that when we start getting that, into that grassroots digging down of it, you do start changing things. For example, you were talking about schooling, and our kids, my kids go to a Rudolf Steiner based school, and the reason why we went down that way is because it is a far more vitalistic and energetic teaching medium. And the interesting reason I mention that is that a lot of that's becoming the largest growing educational philosophy in the world, because people are starting to grasp a hold of this, and we're starting to see that the change in the mindset is starting to happen down low, in some of the almost forming a memeplex that deep down, the green movement and things like that are starting to become, what's my carbon footprint, all this kind of thing that is still very external, what is happening to the environment rather than what is happening to me in my environment. But at least it is a beginning of starting to see that change that is starting to happen. And I think that we are moving in that direction. It's much like when chiropractic was created, 115 years ago or so. We're seeing a very similar time now where that pendulum is swinging. At the time chiropractic came around, there was all the faith healing and the magnetic healing that Dee Dee did and all the other things that were happening at that time that were very much the alternative to standard thought. And I think we're seeing that pendulum swinging back around again, and it's starting to infiltrate. And like you say, little things are starting to sprinkle down to the schools, and we're starting to see some of that. The ideas are starting to change around things, and people are starting to look at ways of being healthier. And at least there is an awareness there. So I think things are starting to change. But at the practice level, you're doing one-on-one. It's, the key I see there is when you start getting the whole families coming in and they're all starting to get the idea, you start to create a bit of an inertia in your community. And that's really what I think it starts to take is helping just to prod along that grassroots movement.
Yeah, and again, this is I try to do this in small bites with people, because they're coming in and the worst thing in the world. I'll give you a perfect example from my real life. Last Thursday, doing some stretches here in the office, getting ready for an afternoon of fun and games, talking to somebody and turned the wrong way and basically just locked up my lower back like nobody's business. I mean, just tore the pelvis. Hello, oh my God, and. I had to work through Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I kind of just took it easy, and then yesterday and today. And my body's better, right? No drugs, nothing. I did some homeopathic stuff, kept doing the things I normally would do, no matter if I was experiencing symptoms or not. I did all my somatic hygiene, whatever you want to call it. And my body responded because it understands the memory pattern. Again, it's much more about, and I think this is probably one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get people out of the material world. When I ask people about, memory, when it comes into the office, I say I'm a memory worker and a miracle worker. Most people have very bad memories of high points in their life. They remember the low because the system's geared for survival. And when they think of the future, they have a very dim imagination because they're told what to think, feel, and act almost all the time by the world. This is a social stress here that, because of all the technology and everything else, they're kind of like immersed in it. Now you have social media come in, which makes them go zigzag all over the place and get everybody else's thoughts. So they never really get to a quiet, centered place that they can actually feel that innate sense of awareness that we're talking about. So you go back to the chiropractic meaning of life with them. I do anyway. And even though I don't run around saying, hey, come to me, I'm Joe Chiropractor anymore, there's only two of us left here in Larchmont, 15 when we started, is that when they come in, it's like, look, I asked them very pointedly, I don't care if they're 5 or 95, what is the meaning of life? And I stop, and I watch, because 90% of the communication is not going to be verbal anyway. And they'll gibber and jabber. They'll give me some, you know, whatever they heard or whatever they read off a bubblegum wrapper. I said, well, I got one for you. Maybe you want to try it on. It's like, and then I give them the second principle that, you know, the chiropractic meaning of life is the expression of intelligence through matter. Sounds complicated, but it really isn't. And then if you add in the factor that people are dealing with an unknown that they don't really trust, which is the future, that they don't have a good image of, it's a wonder anybody gets better. But despite all that, we adapt to things that are just, you know, I don't know if you guys are watching that Life thing on Discovery Channel, all about adaptation. See, that's the other part of the chiropractic science that I think we missed the boat on, is that everything in medicine is about poor adaptation, maladaptation. Everything in chiropractic is about the good, the bueno adaptations. And especially when it comes to stress, everyone thinks stress is bad. No, stress is inevitable. Distress is what you have to learn to avoid. There's eustress. There's good stress. We don't emphasize the ludogenic message at all because we're trained as chiropractors and as practitioners and as people that walk around the world to focus on survival, to focus on immediate need, and to focus on relief. And because of that, it's very hard for someone to get into a mindset that's long-term and that's a compelling future that's real, that they can pull into the present moment by doing very simple, very basic things. And that's, you know, what probably got me in trouble a long time ago, and that's why I'm a weirdo, even in the weirdest profession on the planet, that, of course, has now been called faith healers by the British skeptics. So I guess in our remaining moments here, and we've been talking with Keith Hammond here from several times, actually, from New Zealand. Where do you see this profession going on a global scale when you have so many people that are just suffering, really, where we can't get everybody on a table? We can't get everybody adjusted. If our whole profession comes down to getting people on the table, we're doomed. There's too many other tables with too many other people doing different things to them. How can we get the philosophy, which to me is really the central thesis of what we're doing here, out to enough people that they can actually go in and question the prevailing wisdom that's out there that's screwing them up? How do we do that? We can't do that as it doesn't seem like we can do that individually as practitioners, and politically as a profession with such a mosaic of nutballs and screw-ups. How can we get this message out systemically if we're so mired down in the in all that noise? Give me like your 5-year plan. There you go.
that's a fantastic question. I think the truth of the matter is that there are a lot of people out there who are thinking along the same lines that we do, and there are other healthcare professions that aren't even trying to be mainstream. They're not even trying to approach mainstream. And they're the ones that are actually making a lot more of the noise than we are, because we're all too scared of our own shadow, and we're too busy, you know, circling the wagons and firing inward to actually make a huge difference. Some of the hope for chiropractic that I pin on is outside of America, because America is the chiropractic in America. And again, one of the reasons why I left America was because the chiropractic in America was becoming very bogged down in the politics, and by when you look at some of the practices that are starting to be built, you know, in Europe, down in Australia, here in New Zealand, over in South America, places like that, you're starting to see where they do have a more vitalistic bent. But I think we have to actually start allying ourselves with people who are kind of out on the edge a bit more, rather than trying to ally ourselves with the medical profession. The health profession is wrong. They have they are not a healthcare practice whatsoever. It is a disease and trauma care practice, and they're fantastic at that end. But you know, actually getting people healthy, they have no clue. So we have to go with the people who are actually looking at getting people healthy. And you know, we've got some great people, you know, around here that are doing different works of dealing with the mind and looking at trying to expand out even some of the people who are working with things like emotional freedom technique and things like that, where it is saying, oh, let's, why don't you take that out to the public? You know, you can go on to Mercola's website and you can read how to do it on there, and you've even got a video showing you how to do it, and you can do it at home. And you're right, we won't change things with people on the table. unless we have several million more of us to go around and do the work.
Right.
And
the numbers aren't there.
Outside the states.
Yeah. And
we there's no way.
So that's why, to me, it's like we have to become more socially interactive outside our office, decentralize the profession, not make it all about, and again, this is the business model in chiropractic, is get out into practice and see 400 families and see 9 million people a week and take over your whole town and everything. And it's like that model was what chiropractic was started about when it was in the rural areas and it was trying to take care of people that were far from cities. That was the original B.J. Palmer marketing plan, was that chiropractic was going to be a rural medicine because people couldn't get into the cities to get to the M.D., and this is the way to keep the farmhand from, you know, having gangrene, and you could teach a farmer how to roll a pelvis and adjust an atlas. It was a trade, a handiwork, not a faith healing. And then it got caught up in the competitiveness of it because again, the country was growing leaps and bounds back in the middle of the 20th century. So the distance between country and city kept rapidly diminishing, and it attracted more people from the cities to learn, which of course made it much more of this cosmopolitan, highfalutin, you know, spinal rehabilitative therapy. And once we got into that, well, now we had to prove everything we were doing instead of improve everything we were doing, and we never took care of the language. So I've always said, you know, decentralize. Why do we need the licensureship? Why do we need to meet these mythical standards of validity when we know what we're doing is effective? Homeopaths that went underground during the same time period are now thriving on the Internet, because people don't want to take the meds, and they'll take a remedy. And the remedy, you know, the science behind homeopathy is much more lucid and much more balanced than the science behind chiropractic, because we're still basing it on the old models that were so incomplete 50, 60 years ago, and now we have a decade of the brain sitting there to pick through, and we never discuss it. So I just, like I said, I think what you're saying is true, that we have to get to the point where people can embrace this model from a satellite photo, from a distance, that these are things, the things that we talk about in this philosophy are they're intuitive. Everybody gets it in their gut. It's when it gets up into their head and messes with all that garbage that's up there, all that mental furniture that's up there from watching, you know, 20 years of Big Pharma, you know, drug ads and Lunestra and everything else, is that it's tough to fight that you know, that ground apple of relief when you're really looking for expression. And the thing is, expression might be ugly at first. But the thing is that you have to get past that resistance in order to get to the truth. And I think most chiropractors are so hunkered down, they're so beat up, they're so afraid of losing something that has no meaning, which is their license. And we had this big vitalistic thing here at Life College last April, and I said, you know, basically through the on-purpose filter there, that our buddies over there in New Jersey, the Sopranos there, Gintempo and Kent, that if the chiropractors are serious, if they're absolutely ready to lead anything to anywhere, they have to say, we have to look at, our science is based in vitality, not in health and disease. So that's why diagnosis to us is just a bunch of stories. We don't care about your story. All health is an untreated condition, all disease is a treated condition. It's very simple. The insurance companies figured it out. Let them mess with it. We're focusing on vitality between the one and the zero. And so that should be our first tenet. Our second tenet is that we're officially decentralized. So we buke our license, just like a lot of the DOs did, you know, when they crossed over into the MD land to do more surgery. That we said, look, this license isn't serving us. We're now going to police ourselves. So you reinstitute the PHC, the philosopher of chiropractic, and you make it a master's degree and then a PhD degree, and you make it completely academic. So there's no license to take away. There's just an ongoing, lifelong learning going on. So you're now in a profession that could be interdisciplinary rather than intradisciplinary and isolated. We always want to be separate and distinct because of the legal stuff. And then if we just get rid of the filter between the material and the immaterial realm by discussing things that are scientifically valid, like memory and attention and all the things the shrinks always seem to glom onto and claim, that's their province, is that we can talk about things like having, you know, people go for golf lessons and they talk about muscle memory. There's a P90X program on every 5 minutes at night that talks about muscle confusion. Well, what do you think they're doing? It's just, to me, I think we're just afraid of what we want to say would invalidate everything that we said before. Where MDs, for some reason, can put out the most poisonous, vile drug on the planet, and 5 minutes later come out with a new drug and never apologize. about the drug that was there 5 minutes before, you know, whether it's Fen-Phen or whether it's Allegra, whatever the heck they're poisoning with us now, and they come out with a new drug, and everyone goes, oh, there's a butterfly. Okay, I'll take this one now. And they realize that the public is just interested in relief, and so they don't care about, you know, suspending disbelief and going into it again. But for some reason, we think if we systemically change the way that we go about communicating what we're doing, it isn't about running to the table and getting adjusted all the time. It isn't about trying to avoid the noid, so to speak. It's much more about being able to understand how you're designed and how you function in your world. And if you're functioning at your best, you can thrive on a lot of this stuff rather than just eke out a life and sort of fend off the Undertaker for 80 years. And your emotional intelligence, your contribution to other people's lives can expand. That's the human potential thing we were talking about, I don't know, 25 years ago. We forgot it. I think we just got scared in the wake of the legal slam doors that caused you to jump off the continent. And you know, we got beat up in the Wilk case. We got beat up by managed care. We actually got beat up a little bit by Hillary Care with the whole Mercy document. That's probably the last thing you saw before you got on the plane, was the Mercy document. And now we're sitting here, you know, 12, 13 years later with, you know, Matt McCoy's talking about it's $200,000 to go to chiropractic college. If you're 20 years old, why would you subject yourself to this much persecution and it would cost the same amount to become a DO or to become an MD?
Yeah, I mean it's you're right. That when you posited the idea of moving it to being a purely academic side, that really actually is quite appealing. So, you know, stepping out of the of like I said, the licensure and everything else, and you know, moving into a place where I mean, even funny enough, even in New Zealand, we have where you can just be an unlicensed manipulative therapist, so to speak. So there's nothing barring me from pulling down my shingle and becoming unlicensed. But you know, moving into that more mental space of dealing with people and helping people actually learn to be vital and be healthy. I really like that idea.
Yeah, I posed it to the college presidents and I said, you know, you guys can completely jump the divider here. You're in the school business anyway, and you adopt the brain-based learning model. You teach the 12 principles of brain-based learning that are sitting there that are all about, you know, applying that second principle. Everybody's got a unique brain and a unique way of communicating within themselves. You know, you could discover this. You could actually teach skill sets like EFT and some of these other, you know, allied health disciplines that have propped up over the last 10 or 15 years. There's about 250 of them now. So that the student going through school is not just getting a bunch of head stuff to pass a board that isn't going to matter to them in one whit when they're in practice, but they're actually learning practical ways of helping people right away so they can actually start seeing clients while they're still in school, and then they can go any direction they want to go with it. And then once they become, you know, PhDs instead of PhDs, now they're out there and they can actually run an interdisciplinary clinic that's going to have a whole array of services that's going to all be focusing on enhancing vitality rather than trying to, you know, stave off fatality. You know, we had a 48-year-old guy in Denver, president of Colorado Rockies, former professional athlete, president of the team, dropped dead at 48 years old in Utah today. And everyone's like, why'd he die? Why'd he die? He was perfect. He was in perfect physical shape. Really, I said. You know, because what appears on the outside to be, you know, good surface tension, we don't know what was going on in this guy's core. We don't know what was going on with this guy epigenetically. We don't know what was going on in this guy's life stress-wise. And so when you look at life as much more of a rhythm than a sentence, which is what, you know, medical doctors would talk about, you have a lifespan. It's like here to here. The open identity aspect, the more vitalistic and the more integrated aspects where you as an individual are not isolated in your environment or within your relationships, chiropractic has a lot to contribute there that is way past going to Costa Rica to adjust the villagers and go home. We have to get out of that rescue mentality because we're done with that phase of our development as a profession, but there's too many chicken shit chiropractors that are afraid of losing their license or alienating the medical doctor or pissing off the insurance company or getting the government on their ass. And so I threw up my arms with it last year and I said, look guys, decentralize, deregulate, and go teach. And they won't do it. So, I mean, you got out to a continent there, to a part of the world out there, New Zealand, where people are much more receptive, maybe you're right. Maybe it needs to start outside the states where it isn't so regulated, it isn't so foreign, and then spread here. You know, because, you know, 70%, 75% of the chiropractors are still here in the states, marooned in this you know, this drugless art in a drug culture. Makes no sense. So I guess maybe that's the, maybe you guys could carry the ball for us and start this by you know, giving people more information like McColl has done. McColl is an osteopath. Why would an osteopath be the center of the holistic universe? It's not fair. You know, I just don't understand why we can't get out of this traffic jam we're in because of this god-awful, like, sock-in-the-mouth, you know, stubbornness that we have of being accepted by who? Like, our big brother won't pat us on the head, so we're not good enough. And I just see a lot of people just suffering needlessly in the shadows, searching for what we have and not finding it, and having to go through, you know, 7 or 8 different imposters before they finally find somebody who can give them the real story. So I guess, you know, there's my beef. So I guess, so from your vantage point, looking at health and on the planet and how you deal with things personally and professionally, what's the one thing, the one contradiction that you want to clear up for the listeners tonight as we close up the talk here, that they can walk away from this saying, okay, Keith Hammond taught me blank?
I think the biggest thing that we could look at is saying that if you really want to achieve health and vitality, you do need to have the longer view. You need to be looking toward the distance, looking at, you know, what am I going to be? Create a plan for yourself out in the future of what you want to be and be able to work your way backward. And how can you become that? And periodically revisit that and say, how can I make that even better? What's the new version based on my current understanding of how I could be? How can I even be even better than that? And keep moving yourself forward toward that goal. I think that's the biggest thing that we can work on. And then everything else just feeds back from that.
All right. Well, there you go. That's in the somatic universe. That's called a guiding image, and you could have a guiding image that gets you from here to 6 o'clock tomorrow night, or you could have one that gets you from here to Christmas. As long as you have that image out there, you have what's called a compelling future rather than a repelling one, and you get out of survival, and you have better neuroception, and you have something that you can communicate to others that can share your vision and propel you forward with less effort. So, again, if people just learn that one stinking thing you just said. You realize how many people come out of anxiety, come out of depression, come out of all these things that they're getting drugged and pumped and prodded and put on couches for? It would be amazing.
Absolutely.
It's in the air now, so we'll see. We'll see if somebody opens up their eardrums and hears this. And again, just do you have a website for your practice you want to share with the audience here before we go?
Yeah, our website is www.hasinharry. F as in Frank, C as in Charlie, .net.nz, so for New Zealand.
All right, there you go. And so, you know, this is we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with healthcare around here. I think I know what we're going to do. We're just going to pop 2 more pills and just keep fighting over the same dollar. But hopefully, like I said, I think the answer is out there, what you're talking about.
Well, America does account for 60% of the profits to Big Pharma, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, unfortunately.
No, we like our drugs here. We like our drugs, our sugar, and our diabetes and our heart disease and our cancer. Come on. As long as we got, you know, a wrestling match or the NASCAR race to go to, you know, we're happy.
Well, let me put it in perspective. The largest amount of drugs I've ever had any patient on in New Zealand was 8. And he was in an acute phase. So I never see anybody on that many medications, and that's nothing in comparison to what I'm hearing from people in the States.
I've got kids here under 10 that are on 6 or 7 hardcore meds to get through school. You know, because they keep getting re-diagnosed and reassessed, and people cannot deal with anything outside of what, you know, is considered zombie land for most of these kids, and it's sad. It really is, and again, you know, you're at the bottom of the cesspool. Like a slug in the fish tank here for the most part. So, I what we've laid out here, the answer has to be much more from outside the states and from, you know, communication like on the internet and having some voices that aren't afraid of being heard because of retribution. I will give you my chiropractic license in an envelope with a little mint on the pillow if you would just let me be and do my job. Because that license has never done anything but persecute me and get me in trouble with just about every other chiropractor and every other MD for the last 19 years. It is vestigial, and I think we have to graduate to a level where we're actually able to put words to the music here. And I think you're a shining example of that. Be not afraid. Fred Barge was one of those guys that I never got along with when I was in chiropractic college, but now that he's gone and I got his words to look back on, life without fear is something that keeps me going sometimes, because it's only paranoia if they're not chasing you. You know what I mean? So, but thanks for joining us here on Summertime. You guys keep listening. Keith, hang on for a second, and we'll be back right more to close up the show.
All right. Keith Hammond and me ripping it up over the ocean. Well, meanwhile, here on this side, we have our friend here. Everybody, shimmy. Kika-kaka-tuko-kataka-kika-kaka. Are we hearing this thing? I'm telling you, it's catchy. Every time we have a natural disaster, we'll get a song. We'll show that Mother Nature. Anyway, getting back to what's coming up next. Tomorrow is Earth Day. Hello. Now, Earth Day turns 40. Get out, you. I don't know what to do here. 40th anniversary of Earth Day. Wow. So from the New York Times, Leslie Kaufman talks about the business behind Earth Day. CNS has gone through a whole stream of things the last couple of months with environmental laws and cap and trade, all these things, the green stuff. Earth Day now, of course, gets, mainstream coverage. So strong was the anti-business sentiment for the first Earth Day in 1970, organizers took no money from corporations and held teach-ins to challenge corporate and government leaders. 40 years later, green yogurt, eco-dentistry. It doesn't stop. Bahama Umbrellas advertising a specially designed umbrella with a drain so the water can be stored and reused. Gray Line, New York City sightseeing company, will run its buses on fossil fuels to promote Earth Week. FAO Schwartz is taking advantage, showcasing Pete the Penguin, an emerald-tinted plush toy. Part of its Greensy line, made of soy fibers, and teaches green lessons to children. This is insane stuff. The Penguin, Greensy's promotional, is an ardent supporter of recycling, reusing, and reducing waste. The ridiculously perverted marketing has cheapened the concept of what really is green is. Dennis Hayes, who's the national coordinator of the first Earth Day. It's tragic. So here he is, like the Indian by the side of the road. This year, an updated version of a teach-in, Greenpeace will team up with technology giants like Cisco and Google and hold a web seminar focusing on how to use new technologies like video conferencing and cloud computing to reduce the nation's carbon footprint. Spokesman for Greenpeace said it's necessary to promote a counterweight to the fossil fuel industry. In 1970, Mayor John Lindsay addressed a crowd of tens of thousands in Union Square Earth Day, likened it to a secular revival meeting. This year, Mayor Bloomberg will be in Times Square to announce measures to reduce New York's impact on the environment. Using the same stage, Keep America Beautiful, an anti-littering nonprofit organization, was just Dream Machines, recycling kiosks existing with Pepsi. The machines are meant to increase the recycling rates about 36% nationwide. Well, why do I mention all this stuff? It's because we have such an extreme sort of love-hate relationship with the environment. First we pollute it, now we're protecting it. We're still separate from it, is what I'm trying to say. And along those lines, this is talking about the greening of our culture, is, that sort of enforced belief system stuff, where it's not something that they're going to mandate all this stuff eventually. The original Earth Day was attended by 20 million. This year, they'll be widely marked with events, climate rally on the Mall in Washington. Oh, boy. Every Earth Day is a reflection of where we are as a culture. It's become commoditized, about green consumerism instead of systemic change as a reflection of our society. We made it into a brand. So speaking of that, MSNBC, now they've been doing this all week long. I said at the top of the show, 3 o'clock, Donny Deutsch was hosting this show called Angry in America. Now he gets taken off the air for dissing Oberman. So I had to play this clip to see what he did that was so terrible. Let's see. Get this thing to work. They're not going to show it the next 2 days. We're too angry. Can't be criticizing each other.
Special series, America the Angry. We've looked at anger at Wall Street, the anger that leads to domestic terror, and even anger at celebrities. But what about the media? Any change some of the anger Americans are feeling is a reflection of and what they hear on radio and see on TV. Of course it is. And on the Internet, you be the judge.
Barack Obama is president of the United States today because of stupid, ignorant people who think like you do.
Well, are you an idiot?
Millimeter
are you an
US
absolute
sir, don't
idiot?
Call me. You know what? What you
I'll call you anything
right
I want.
Is exactly what I'm talking about.
And you're part of the problem.
Sir, he doesn't have a right to be here.
He commit a felony.
He doesn't have a right to be in this country.
What? But that has nothing to do with the
yes,
fact that
does.
He was drunk.
He should have been with
that
drunk.
Embarrassed your district, embarrassed your state, embarrassed your party, embarrassed your nation, shouted at the president like he was a referee at a ball game and you were a drunk in the stands, and you were wrong.
When the hell are you going to stand up, America?
Hugh Hewitt is a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. Paul Farhadi covers media for the Style section, Washington Post, and Karen Hunter is a journalist and publisher. Hey, Karen, let me say something crazy here. Let's take the last guy, Glenn Beck, who I pretty much disagree with everything he says, but so what? He's an entertainer. Why don't we put the pin in everybody and stop worrying? Oh, of course there's anger in the media. Of course all these guys are crazy. Of course. So what? You know what? Entertain, say what you're going to say. Who cares?
Well, I think we need to stop referring to these people as journalists and as part of the media. They are entertainers. Even Glenn Beck said that about himself. That's all reality TV right there that you just showed. That was not media, and it was not journalism.
Hugh, isn't there, and I was kind of surprised when the president kind of fired back at Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck at different points in time. Hugh, you've got a big following there. You're a conservative guy. At the end of the day, don't we kind of elevate you guys too much by saying that you're anything other than just another person on the street spouting off? And just like if there's a guy at the end of the bar and he's spouting stuff, you just kind of turn the other way. Am I crazy? Is it too easy for me?
It's too easy for you, Donny. There are, of course, distinctions between people on any type of media, whether television or radio. I mean, position heel yourself. When you guys get rid of Ed Schultz and Keith, then I'll start to think that you're actually serious here because they are the biggest hate mongers in television.
But I'm not taking side of either one. I guess my point is wherever you come out on Ed and Keith, wherever you come out on Glenn and Bill O'Reilly, it's like, so what? Just like I could line up 1,000 guys in the room, and you can always have guys that are outrageous and over the top, but why are we even allowing America to believe that these people are really, you know, kind of informing our brains? Maybe I think people are brighter than they are?
It depends entirely on what credibility they bring to the table. If you spend, like I do, 3 hours interviewing Lawrence Wright about the looming tower, I think I might know something about what's in that book. And if you spout off about something you don't know about, then I think you don't deserve much credibility. It depends upon the source. You got to go source by source. But MSNBC should start with Ed Schultz, who's just kind of a joke.
That's a ridiculous thing to say. He's a joke. He's a guy. Forget you can disagree with my point. Disagree with everything he says. Disagree with everything he says and say, you know what? And I think he says it loud and too crazy. So what? That's the way wherever you come out on these things. And I'm clearly a guy who's a little further to the left, but my kind of whole new thing is like just we got to calm down a little bit. Paul, forget whether you're a Glenn Beck guy, whether you're an Ed Schultz guy, whether you're a Keith Olbermann guy, whether you're a Bill O'Reilly guy. Just say, let them all scream at the wind. So what?
Yeah, but these guys have followings, Donnie, and, you know, people don't make distinctions between who's a journalist, who's a blogger, who's a commentator, who's a host on TV. It's basically a guy on television yelling at them and telling them they should be angry. And, frankly, there are good reasons to be angry.
They're not
creating the anger. The anger is there. They are simply exploiting what already exists.
Donnie, Lady Gaga has followers. That does not make a person, you know, credible enough to lead people, and I think you've hit on something. At the end of the day, people can't have common debate in this country, intelligent debate in this country, without information, and we're no longer doing the job as journalists. There was a time when Walter Cronkite got on the airwaves, and you knew that he was telling you something that was important. Today, I teach at Hunter College. Students don't even know where Iraq is on the map.
You know, Hugh, my point is this. Once again, let's go on your hate of Ed Schultz, or he should be off the air. What if I said to you, you know what?
I didn't say he should be off the air, Donnie. I don't hate him. I think he's a joke. I spend I spend my time talking to people like Jonathan Alter. I just know Ed's not.
But guess my point is, who are you or anybody to judge where the intellectual high ground is? I say these are all entertainers in one form or another.
It's objective. You can look at any show and decide whether or not there's an objective seriousness there, whether or not someone brings intellectual heft and knowledge and information and interviews to the table. It's not that hard to judge who's serious, Charlie Rosen, who's not, Ed Schultz, and decide who deserves credibility like I do, like Bill Bennett does, like Dennis Prager, like Michael Medved.
You're part of the problem because you're not opening up the discussion for people to have intelligent debate. You're just saying this guy's an idiot, this guy's a joke, this guy's stupid, but why?
Okay,
let's have some
disagree with you. Clearly you've never heard the show, but I think EJ Dionne and Jonathan Alter and people like that who are friends of mine and good lefties come on and talk to me in a serious, sustained way over a long period of time. Ed Schultz doesn't do that. He doesn't have the ability to do that.
I got to say something. You are the problem. A guy like Ed Schultz, who once again, you can disagree with him, but this is a quality human being. And, you know, I don't know Glenn Beck, but Ed Schultz is trying to do the right thing. Why don't you just say, you know what, I disagree with this guy. Why do you have to say he's a joke? I happen to know the man. Once again, disagree with everything he says. But his heart's in the right place. Glenn Beck,
he's just not that smart.
You know what?
Objectively, he doesn't know very much.
Not helping anybody. Glenn Beck, once again, I disagree with everything he says. Say it. I don't care. Knock yourself out. I don't need to say you're a moron. I don't need to say. That's it. Enough with this stuff. Paul, I appreciate it. Karen Hunter, thank you. Eddie, I'm in there fighting for you, buddy. Once again, I don't agree with everything you said, but you know what? I applaud your right to say it. Keeping our...
Wow, and Olbermann's mad at him. The guy comes out and throws Ed Schultz straight under the bus. Goodbye. Wow, that was fun. Angry at America. Oh, and then he gets the plug pulled on him. It's amazing. It's amazing. Read him. Actually, I think we got to close the show with that song. I gotta find me a little George Michael here to just mellow myself out after all that venom. Donnie Deutsch getting in over his little Philo head there. Where are we here? We need a little freedom. Where's George? Frank Sinatra. There we are. So there's your kind of introduction to Earth Day, Earthlings. People talking about anger and the media, and then the media gets angry. Beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. So since nobody's around and we got an overtime hockey game here, I'm going to pedal out of this buppy. First, I got to play that song one more time. There's just so many things to say for our little earthquake. Earthquake. We don't have a song for the earthquake. The Haitians get no song. Nope. There's no song for the earthquake. What was that? 8.4. Down there in Chile. But Acacuco Caca, that gets the song. Ba-ba-da-ba. Can't wait for the second volcanic eruption. Yeah. Dance remix of Sandy Hofstvig. Background vocals by Andy Hamilton. It's EYJAFJALLAJOKULL. Matt Gibson. Unbelievable. Anyway, I think that's our show for the evening here. Let's see if there's anybody left. Chat room has no questions. Post no bills. So next week, full moon. Full moon night. Can't wait. I don't know what we're going to be talking about. Maybe this stuff. Maybe this anger stuff. Maybe we'll get one of our three blind mice from last week that couldn't get on here to explain me what's going on. What's going on? Until then, you know, the stress is yours. So I'm going to try and play a little peaceful song here to play us out. Getting off the air a couple minutes early, but, you know, after that Donnie Deutsch diatribe. Well, you know what? I do want to see if I can find it. Let me see if I can find it really quick. I go over to the YouTube,
YouTube. Because it was pretty funny. YouTube. Along the lines of the anger in the media thing, as we get close to Earth Day. It was pretty funny. He was going off on Jon Stewart slams Fox News again. Here we go. Let's see.
Thanks, Stan Withers and Bill O'Reilly in the Weekdays at Bernie segment tonight.
Oh,
perhaps the most persistent critic of Fox News on TV these
wait
days
a minute,
is
wait a minute.
Central's Jon Stewart. Last week, Mr. Stewart was at it again.
No, no, no. I want to see the other one. Bernie View. No, no, no. Jon Stewart interviews George Carlin. No, not tonight, kiddies. It was... Oops. Oops. You know, I sometimes I get ambitious with this, and sometimes I just lose my mind here. Lose my mind, lose my mind. Let me go to Comedy Central, folks. Because it's annoying. You want to play something funny, and you have 40 minutes to find it, and you don't find it. But it was funny. And it's worth finding. And I'm on the air, you're not. I'm just moving around. Daily Show. Love that Daily Show. I don't know what Conan's going to do to compete with it. Oh, the twists and the turns of reality. Look at this thing. Slow as can be. So next week, I'm not sure who's coming on the show. We have like five people I'm thinking about. The topic is going to be this tension, though. April closing with tension. Lots and lots of tension. Did Boston just win this game? Did Buffalo just win this game? No. Oh, they just, we're between periods and overtime. We're going to a double overtime here. It's going to be way cool. You're going to be up watching that. So let's see. Shows. Daily Show. I just want to see this little song you made about Gary Goldberg. Barry Goldberg. Very funny. Funny, funny, funny. Oh, here we go. All right, because you know when you get an Anto mad, you get something like this. So to ramp us into this, let's see.
Edgy? I never thought I was edgy. And
oh wait, let's see. Just want to make sure this is what.
That's further evidence of how the rest of the media.
This is the best. I guess we'll pick it up from here. Hang on a second.
I'm not going to lie on that one. I took that one right.
Hang on there, Stuart.
You're not nearly.
Here we go. All right. A little bit of this.
You're just a safe Jay Leno with a much smaller audience, but you get to say the F-bomb. Okay, that's going to leave a mark. Yeah, okay, that one stung. I'm not going to lie on that one. I took that one right in the testicles. That was... Look, again, two things. Whoever said I was edgy? I never said I was... Edgy? I never thought I was edgy. And number two, if you think I'm Leno with the F-bomb, you know less about comedy than you do about media and politics. This is Leno with the F-bomb.
Look.
I mean, can you believe it? It's a typo. Circus judge? Who can a ass make that kind of mistake? Goddamn second stick. You hear me with the F-bombs? I can't stop myself.
Dirty.
No wonder Primetime couldn't handle him. You're just a safe Jay Leno with a much smaller audience, but you get to say
the F-bomb, which gives your incredibly unsophisticated audience the illusion.
You're generalizing.
The illusion that you're courageous and that you're a renegade, but it's only an illusion.
Wait! I'm not a courageous renegade? But I've always considered myself the Lorenzo Lamas of late night. And as far as my audience being unsophisticated...
Balderdash!
Wait, I'm sorry, who said that?
It is I, your biggest fan, Toppington von Monocle. Unsophisticated? How dare he? If I may quote Catullus, pedicavo ego vos et irimabo.
I'm sorry, Mr. von Monocle, I don't speak Latin.
It means I will sodomize you and face you.
All right, skipping ahead here. When we get to the song, because this is what's really funny to me. It goes on and on here with making fun of our friend Barry. This is some funny crap here at the end.
Baby, I don't want to fight.
Hang on here. Come on.
More unsophisticated in...
I know that I criticize you and Fox News a lot.
Yeah, here we go.
Because you're truly a terrible, cynical, disingenuous news organization.
Oh, wait, no, you know what? That's the wrong approach. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be confrontational. I want to take a minute to talk directly to Bernie Goldberg. Baby, I don't want to fight, baby. And I know you've been hurt before by them liberal elites.
They've done you wrong, Bernie.
Don't let that close your heart, brother. I don't hate
what
you.
I call him Barry? Bernie.
I mean, you're not Dick Moore.
Thank you, Barry.
What's wrong with that guy?
Yeah, seriously.
He's starting to look like that guy from Men in Black.
Which one?
You know from the first one, the guy who came down and walked around in other people's skin.
But Shalhoub?
No.
The Vincent D'Onofrio guy.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. You see, I've learned people are complicated, Bernie, and hard to categorize. I mean, I've got some conservative views.
He's a pro-military motherfucker, peace to the troops.
I've got some libertarian views.
Legalize it.
Gay marriage.
Uh-huh.
Pot.
Uh-huh.
Gay pot marriage.
Now you make
And I know that I can be intolerant.
Lactose and otherwise, don't let this man eat any pussy.
And I believe this country should provide some kind of social safety net for our most vulnerable citizens.
Communists.
And I also believe power should be passed down to the firstborn son of the reigning king.
Monarchists.
And I believe in ghosts. Boo! But I will tell you this, Bernie Goldberg. Oh, Bernie Goldberg, I will tell you this, Bernie Goldberg. That's the editing.
Not funny.
I try to be funny.
Why don't you watch the movie? I don't have time to watch all the guest movies.
My point is this.
He's got a point now.
Bernie Goldberg, I don't need to satisfy your version of what fair satire is or should be. I'm not fair. I'm not balanced.
He's unstable.
That's not what I meant.
He's Coco Loco.
Thank you. You're criticizing me for not living up to your tagline.
Oh, Lord.
And you dismiss any criticism as further evidence of how the rest of the media persecute you. You like to pretend, Bernie Goldberg and Fox News, that the relentless conservative activism of Fox News is the equivalent. Oh, the equivalent of the disorganized liberal influence you find on NBC, ABC, and CBS. But Fox News, you may be able to detect a liberal pathogen in their bloodstream, however faint. But Fox News is such a crazy overreaction to that perceived threat. You're like an autoimmune disorder. I'm not saying the virus doesn't exist in some small quantity, but you're producing way too many antibodies.
Fox News, you're the Lupus of news. So, I guess what I'm saying is this.
Go!
As long as fair and balanced is how you sell yourselves. Guess what I'm saying is this.
Okay, I've had my fun. Holy cow. Can this thing ever shut up? God, you know, just once. All right, back to Napster. So, thanks, kids, for hanging out for that little John Stewart indulgence. I had to play it. It was funny the first five times I saw it. Look at this bunt, perfect bunt. Mets are down by three here in the ninth. First, second, nobody out. Looks like a doomsday for the Metsies. So we'll see you again Wednesday night next week at 9 o'clock. Again, check out the website at somaspace.org, the evolving website at somaspace.org, Unveiling Domania on Facebook, and OVI on Facebook. We're moving it over. Get the woo to you. Because, you know, there's a lot of woo to do, and there's only so many hours in the day. And we got to, you know, he's got a bone. Anyway, play me out here, George. Peace be with you. Travel light through the darkness. And may your daughter never run into Ben Roethlisberger in a college bar. Be yourself and be well. See you next week at 9. Here on Zoma Time. Rock me now. Yeah. Of course, you can always get a hold of me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. Any questions? All right. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Keith Hammond, from tomorrow. We got that at March over there in Washington. We got to find Doc at one point, see what happened down there. Not much of a reaction. We're just too stressed out about this whole Ben thing.
Avalanche in 7. Happy Earth Day, Sapiens. Spiral on now. Let's go, Mets.